Coming to you from cities all over the world, produced in Aotearoa, New Zealand, this is the Places for Good podcast. We bring you the designers, planners, and placemakers who shape the shared spaces of tomorrow, from stories of the past to visions for the future. We talk pride of place wherever you are. I'm your host, Boopsie Moran.
Our guest today joined the University City District in 2012 and has served as the Director of Planning and Design since 2015. He uses his urban design expertise and dedicated enthusiasm to enhance urban quality of life issues throughout the University City in Philadelphia, USA. During the COVID-19 pandemic, he served as an expert advisor to the City of Philadelphia to develop the pandemic outdoor dining guideline for the entire city in 2020. Nate is passionate about the belief that streets are public spaces in line with thinking. He is one of the founding members of Open Streets Philadelphia. The group successfully lobbied for and developed an Open Streets event in Philadelphia in less than a year. Please welcome Nate Hummel.
Thank you, Boopsie. It's great to be here. I appreciate it.
Well, it's so nice to be zooming in from New Zealand to Philly. And I just want to learn more about how you developed your Open Streets or your parklet, actually, policy outdoor dining during COVID.
Yeah, well, it's wonderful because Philadelphia, really right from the beginning, really second week of March 2020, was one of the cities that took it very seriously, and just everything kind of stopped, where nobody could have anything outside. Restaurants were closed, bars were closed. And that was quite a change. Philadelphia, New York, Chicago, some of the bigger East Coast cities in the United States really had this, where concentrations of COVID were high, and it just everybody got shut down. So it went fairly well. But then after a couple of months, people really said, we miss our restaurants, we miss our, but we have to do something. We can't just do this. Like, takeout worked for a lot of places, but it wasn't the same. You missed that. To go back into, to jump right into jargon from urbanism, but that third place that everybody was missing, those third places where you could just be, where it wasn't home, where it wasn't work, and somewhere else. That started to eat away at people. And then so the city kind of came to us and asked a couple questions. How can we repurpose the curb lane of our streets? The reason why they came to us is because back in 2011, we were the first organization that brought parklets to Philadelphia. So Rebar and their team out in San Francisco was creating parklets back in 2010. My predecessor, Prima Gupta, who really was the one that brought them to Philadelphia, convinced the city back then, like, this is an experiment. We want to try and find a way to do something different in our streets. And there were all of these people. The initial reaction was, oh my goodness, that's crazy. We'll never be able to do this. Despite the fact that Philadelphia is a really walkable city, more so than almost every other American city, because of its age, it's been around one of the oldest cities in our country, but it was a city that was formed way before the car. And so everything is at a walking scale, a lot of places. And so it's always seemed to us like a place where people wouldn't mind more outdoor dining and stuff. So they let us do it. But the way our city works, the way a lot of major cities work, you can't just say, sure, we're going to change the rules, we're going to do this thing. This started out as a pilot. So we had traffic engineers that were in meetings with us convinced that the very first car to come down the street after the park was installed was going to drive right over the parklet and mow down every person on it. And we had other people that said, well, that's absurd. That never happens. And so it's this mix within city engineering. And we, as a nonprofit, are just sort of saying, like, could we do this? Is this possible? And it worked out really well. We had some good progressive people back in 2011 in city government in Philadelphia that were willing to say, okay, if we can't say yes to this, how do we say maybe? And a way to say maybe is allowing a pilot program, or allowing a term that I've actually come to use, a non-permanent installation. So engineers like hearing non-permanent. It sort of gets to what they want. But at the same time, for the public, it doesn't sound like a temporary thing that's going to be here for just a couple of minutes. So all of these things allowed us to do these parklets back in 2011.
With the 2012 model that you created, What does that look like in 2020 as far as host responsibility? And the biggest issue we're having here is, are they allowed to drink alcohol in the parklet? And how does that work?
It's a great question, because they're two philosophically different things, and there's actually a new word. So in this world of placemaking, you've come across a fair number of portmanteaus, where just words are slammed together. Parklet, streetery is our new one. So streetery, small park, parklet. The difference between the two, at least in Philadelphia city government's eyes, a parklet is pure public space. That means it can be in front of a restaurant, but the people that use that space do not have to spend any money at all at that restaurant. They can sit there for as long as they want, as long as they're not doing what we generally refer to as, you know, socially unacceptable behaviors. For the most part, anybody can sit there. Streeteries that came during the pandemic were very different. So the purpose of the streeteries was to give the restaurants some chance to survive. Give them, if they couldn't have people sitting inside, they could still have the wait staff, they could still have the kitchen staff, all those people employed, but serving people outside. Those rules had to be changed. And so because of the emergency declarations that were happening, a lot of red tape got sliced right through and things just happened. And so the city said, fine, even though technically between the curbs is the right of way, and technically that should be for all Philadelphians, not some in particular, they said, this is different. We're going to allow restaurants to have streeteries in front of their restaurants, and everybody that sits in them has to spend money. Those restaurants can tell anybody they can or cannot sit there based on how much money or if they've spent money at that restaurant.
And did you have
That was built off of our parklet program. So if we didn't have that parklet program first, the city wouldn't have any idea even how to, like, how does this even work? How do we have curbside seating? How do we have hosts? How do we have, and so our model of a host is volunteers to take care of the tables and chairs and things on our parklets. And that worked really well for a number of years. We pay for the plants. We take care of any maintenance things, but the host does the basic stuff and they keep the eyes and the ears on that. What happens in the restaurants is the restaurants, and then we paid for everything. We paid for the platform, the tables, the chairs, the plants. We got all the approvals. We did the insurance. We, the nonprofit University City District. So what, and then we had six parklets, six in West Philadelphia. When the Streeteries program went live and they cut through all that red tape and they had the restaurants be responsible for paying for the streetery, for assembling it, for taking care of it, for maintaining it, for cleaning it, all of those things that we helped out, each individual restaurant now does it on their own. There's over 800 of these in Philadelphia now.
And wow, so 800 just, from six.
From our six parklets, yeah, to now 800 of these streeteries and sidewalk cafes throughout our city. There was something like, there were a couple of hundred outdoor seating, like cafe seating in our downtown area, but not in the fringe neighborhoods before that, maybe 200 or so total. Now there's 800.
And so have any health advisors come forward to say how safe and how much better this is as an option during the pandemic? Has any studies been done that this is a safer way to dine during COVID?
Yeah, and it got into airflow, and there's a lot of stuff there with, everybody became an amateur airflow expert real quick in Philadelphia. And so everybody is sure that no matter what happens inside, we cannot ever make that work. And as long as we're outside, we're fine. But there were restrictions. So the Philadelphia came up with a wonderful document. The city government came out with this thing. It was the City of Philadelphia Pandemic Guidelines. And I can send you a link to that. It was a basic thing, but it basically laid out all these rules that made it very clear in a way that I have not seen the city do before that, but it was this really useful guide with images and keeping it simple, because the thought was, we're not going to have people like Nate, 20 years experience in urban design, knowing all the red tape of how to cut through a city and It was like busy restaurant. And now our restaurants, all of a sudden, the owner was the chef, taking orders, was doing everything, because they had to fire everybody. They couldn't afford to keep anybody on staff because they had to change everything. So you have these people that are already stretched so thin, they're already crazy. Now they have to learn city government. So the city did amazing things. They said 3-day turnaround. If you submit an application for a street tree, we, the city, will give you a rejection or approval within 3 days. That was amazing. And they held up to it. They did it. So all those 600 additional street trees got their approval in 3 days. Instead of needing an engineer and an architect to sign off on plans and say exactly this distance from a fire hydrant, all this stuff, they treated it like they treat almost everything else. So our terminology for it is by right. So zoning allowed for it if you met these certain provisions. You didn't have to have all these laid out rules and everything, but it was just, if it met it, it worked. And so that becoming by right helped so many of these places just look at it and say, okay, this fits. We have this much space in front of our restaurant. We don't have a fire hydrant right in front of our restaurant. Yeah. We don't have a fire.
My one question is after the rules were set up, were there certain agencies that were private that came across, and did they start building them so that they could roll out faster? Because it would be quite tricky to get the platform done if you weren't a builder. So, and also in the past, parklets had a perfect size of 40 feet. The street eateries have a different width and a different length. Just as far as design goes.
Yeah. So those are, again, exactly things that we were dealing with during this stuff. And so the length of them, we found 40 was the one that makes people the most comfortable in a parklet pre-pandemic. But now that the world's changed, they were all thinking, I can have one as wide as my restaurant. The Philadelphia Row House is anywhere from 13 to 17 feet wide. Most restaurants are in a row house first floor. So that usually gives them, they're about 20 feet, one car parking space. In Philadelphia, 7 feet by 20 feet is a car parking space. But if you have, and they were also doing, you could extend. So if there was, so many places were closed. So the place next to you was say they were not there or everybody was working remotely. Mm-hmm. You could get permission for that property owner to extend your streetery into the next building. So mm-hmm. you can add along. When this started becoming really popular, so as summer of 2020 started happening, certainly in the fall of 2020, and lots more streeters are showing up, then people started making restrictions. The fire code, whatever it was inside, you could not exceed that even with your outdoor seating, which is a little strange, but you know, whatever. We have pretty cold winters here, not terrible by any means, but cold enough. And so there was a lot of you know, our parklets had to come in the winter. These stayed out, and that changed a lot of things with heaters
in the car.
They did year round. So we had people were eating outside in January and December. And for us in Philadelphia, that's freezing or slightly below freezing temperatures, snow routine, ice is routine. And people were gladly eating outside they had tents and there were heaters, and it was amazing because it felt safer. And so there were very few, if any, cases reported of people getting COVID from outdoor dining. It's hard to report that directly, but still it seemed like something, the consumer felt comfortable. By and large, the citizens of Philadelphia took COVID seriously. In other parts of the country, it's very different. But Philadelphia took it very seriously. Yes. I mean, people got frustrated towards, you know, with certain things, but overall took it seriously. And it became about consumer confidence. And the consumers were just not going into restaurants. So even if they allowed restaurant seating, people still weren't going.
Yeah,
and then they had to have the tables.
They trusted the science, so they act accordingly. And so they needed that faith from government. So what roles did the planning and Ministry of Transport and the mayor have in this being legally safe? Like, was there any discussions you had to be a part of with the strategy team where the planning was like, yep, I can go and change that? Or the mayor was like, just do whatever it takes for consumer confidence. Who was at play in the higher bureaucratic roles that really helped pursue this change?
In Philadelphia, there's both a strong mayor and a weak mayor city. It's very interesting. So strong mayor in that our mayor is very powerful and has a lot of control, but also we have council districts that are fiefdoms within Philadelphia, and they also have very much control over their districts. So there was strong belief from the mayor, our Mayor Kenny, that we had to do something. Outdoor dining has to be a way forward. That we, the city, have this parklets program, can there be something that adjusts for that? The city, amazingly, our commerce department, so the city department that really deals with businesses and deals with restaurants, they took a humongous burden and said, "This is our, these are our restaurants, these are our independent businesses that are all struggling. How can we help them? How can we help them survive?" So the commerce department really came up big, and then also the streets engineering department. And so they had to say, okay, we can do this, but not that. Or we can allow you to do some of this stuff, but you got to let fire trucks come through, and you have to let ambulances come through. And it, so there was this balance. And then what they did, which I thought was amazing, and cities don't do this very often, but Zoom allowed this to happen. The city pulled in a lot of people that were outsiders, didn't work for city government, that did this stuff. And I think because it was Zoom and we could just check in for a half hour or something from anywhere, we didn't have to go downtown and have our meeting, it made it a lot easier for a lot of people that were living in this world of implementing these things to talk with the regulators and say, these are the problems we have. What if we made some adjustments? What if we change this? Or, hey, I've been doing parklets for 10 years. Here's one really difficult thing, which was getting 51% of approval from people that lived on that block to remove one parking space as if parking is a right. Sometimes in America, it feels like parking is a right. It is not. But to take away one parking space on a street for a parklet, so again, that's pre-pandemic,
yes,
we needed 51% approval from people on that block to say, yes, we're okay with this. During the pandemic, I was like, how are we ever going to do that? There's no way. People are living, these students, a lot of students live in University City. They're not, who knows where? They're certainly not in Philadelphia. How are we going to get a hold of them to get their approval? So they waived that. The city waived the approval and just said, if that's where it switched to that by right. Now, 2 years in, people are complaining and saying, we need to think about this a little bit differently. Mm-hmm. But the ability of the city to basically harness actual working individuals that were doing this stuff to say, how can we make this more efficient? How can we make this better for the end user? It's stuff like that that allowed the city to do these things in 3-day turnarounds, yes, and allow those restaurants, because it became this collective, we're all in it together.
Yeah, problem solving. Well, I'm looking at that you were the pandemic outdoor dining guideline. So when you created that guideline, right? When you were in that.
And the city created that entirely on their own with our people like my advice.
Oh, okay, fantastic. So when they made
city
that,
did that
guideline,
all on their own.
Is it a trial or is it a, this is the, you have the street eateries? That's the question, right? Because now that people are saying, rethink it, go, let's go a little bit back, hone it in and give me a couple more car parks. When they declared that pandemic outdoor dining guideline, was it as a pilot or was it as this is how it is indefinitely?
So it was an emergency declaration, and that carried a ton of weight in Pennsylvania as a state and in the city of Philadelphia. And so that emergency declaration allowed the streets department a whole bunch of power to shut down streets, to control streets and say, we need to do this and that. And that gets into the liquor controls. So we have, Pennsylvania is really strange. We have the Pennsylvania Liquor Control Board. The state of Pennsylvania buys all wine and spirits in the state and then sells it. It's ridiculous. It's the only state, I believe, or one of the only states that does that.
We have a part that does that in Auckland as well.
So we're kindred spirits in that way. So it's really, it's a challenge. But that emergency declaration cut a lot of that red tape. It's basically what it did. It allowed emergency things to happen. It allowed things to go quickly without having to think through every myriad option of what could possibly go wrong. It was just like, let's do it. And then we'll see what happens. And so that's basically how
people...
it did for 2 years. That emergency declaration comes to a close at the end of this calendar year.
Oh.
And so now there's bills coming through city government to make these streeteries permanent. New York City just said, fine, we're making them permanent. New York City, although it's a very old city, their streets are much wider than our street. And so it's very different. Their streets and boulevards and avenues are much, much wider streets. It's different for them, at least from width standpoint. When we're coming through and doing this process, and again, the city, to their credit, is doing, bringing in those experts again on these various committees that work with city council to try and explain to them, this is what it is. This is what we need to you know, this is what it means to the people, all those things. But that is to say, all of this stuff and the Liquor Control Board were able to happen, and Philadelphia did not burn to the ground. Philadelphia did not become a city of drunken, crazy lunatics that were causing mayhem everywhere. So these like horror stories that people used to always say would happen didn't really materialize. And so that's a good thing. The fact that 800 streeteries now exist where there used to be cars parked and it hasn't caused Armageddon.
Yes.
Well, that's interesting. Like, why didn't it cause riots? What, you know, it's like, so I think a lot of that stuff that some people in my line of work would dream, or in our line of work would dream of this scenario where you could redo this stuff, but it became an emergency. How can we help these businesses stay open? How can we help those people? How can we keep those kitchens staffed? How can we keep those all of that stuff, all those people that were involved? That's what it came down to. And that was a fundamental shift early in the pandemic. When I was talking to the public, when I was talking to city officials, when I was doing interviews, I was never talking about my urbanism goals. It was never about that, because honestly, it was not at all what we were thinking. We knew from 20 years of me personally hacking into systems and knowing how to do different things, I knew how to get in there and how to manipulate the system and make things happen. But the only goal was to try and keep as many of these restaurants open. And we found out people wanted to dine outside, that they felt comfortable doing that. We said, can we just do more of this? How can we get as many people involved? And so I think when you have all those things come together, that red tape is kind of cut out, and people can, okay, so we don't have all those checks and balances everywhere. Yeah. We let things go through. Well, some bad apples get through, and some things happen, and there are problems. And that comes up a lot. Uh-huh. But one thing we like to say is we don't call things that come in, we don't call them complaints. Yep. We call them feedback. Mm-hmm. And so sometimes there's positive feedback and sometimes there's negative feedback. Mm. So we get, when feedback comes in on these things, often the negative feedback that happens is the result of a couple of bad actors that were causing trouble. And so one of the things to think about in the permanent idea, again, not in that emergency declaration, they were like, we don't need to figure all this stuff out now. We just let them do it. And then we'll try and figure out stuff later.
Yeah.
So now as we're trying to figure stuff out later, we're thinking, okay, what are the penalties if you have a decrepit structure? Mm-hmm. What do you do with a structure if the restaurant goes out of business and they just skip town and they leave the thing in the street? Like, so there has to be, I mean, not that that stuff happens all the time.
But I guess there's that most. But also my other question is, if they have like a club, let's say a club that is a bar, are bars allowed street eateries? Like a place that had...
Yeah.
Liquor as the priority and food as the side?
It's great. And so even within the emergency declaration, there were nuances. And so if you also sold food, you could sell beer and be open and do that stuff. If all you did was sell beer and didn't sell any food, you couldn't be open. There are so many bars in Philadelphia, an old city, where it's just an old bar and that's all they have. And they couldn't be open. Legally, they couldn't be open. Like, no one's going to get a takeout hot dog from us. Like, who's going to get food from us? Some people just totally like, you know, game the system and figured out ways to do it. But it was, so to allow that, I mean, at first we had, you know, the city in the United States that allows this all the time is New Orleans.
Yeah.
Where you have cocktails to go and you have walk-up windows. And that was happening. And it was, I live in a part of the city called Fishtown, which is this really walkable neighborhood. It was great. You could just walk up to the side of a restaurant and grab a frozen margarita. So it was fun. That went away. The cocktails to go, they decided, okay, we can't keep doing that. So that's not a thing anymore. The restaurants were like, if we can keep outdoor dining, we're not going to fight for the cocktails to go. Fine. You could take that away from us. But it was something that they at first said, okay, just do it. We don't want you guys to have to lay off all your staff. It was so like,
if a bar wants a parklet, can a bar have a parklet is my question.
A parklet, no.
I'm sorry, a street, can a bar?
A streetery, they can if they serve food also.
Okay. So,
and I don't know the exact nuance of how much food they have to serve. it's in that guidelines,
yes.
that book of guidelines. It's all in there. They spell it out of this is what you need to do. And so,
because you have your favorite pub, right? And maybe, I guess they some have food, but there's a couple of late night bars that I think that would just be like, are they okay now in Philly if they're mostly indoors? Do they exist? Are they still being frequented?
There's one place near here in Fish. The neighborhood I live in is on the other side of town from where University City, where I work. But the neighborhood where I live in is like this entertainment capital. And there's this DJ club place kind of near my house. And I saw they put out a parklet. I was like, they don't serve food.
Yeah.
What is this? Early in the pandemic. And then I'm not out late at night during the pandemic. Uh-huh. So I pretty much stayed in the house. So I'm trying to figure this out. They made a disco streetery where they brought out DJs and they were just people partying in the street.
Yeah,
so they tried that. So yeah, and then the city was probably like, "That's not what we meant." But also, this isn't the end of the world. There's little things like that. But for the most part, one thing it absolutely did. For those kind of one-off things, and there was certain like nightclub that sort of industry. I mean, that was just decimated, and things couldn't be open past 10 p.m. and then till 11 or midnight. These are places that are used to be opening up all night. And so that, as far as I know, I'm 42 years old with two kids. I don't go out clubbing very often. So I don't know, maybe that's come roaring back, but I don't think it has.
Yeah,
I think it's still pretty slow here.
So my other question
go
ahead, finish that point if you want.
Well, no, it's like the amazing thing. One thing I have been trying to convince city officials for years and years and years and years is you don't have to be perfect. This doesn't, what your idea going forward does not have to be the most perfect, well thought out thing. Try it, see if it works, make adjustments, do what we do, this tactical urbanism, iterations, then think about it. The problem, and this might be the case in New Zealand as well, but in the United States, if you do that, you can be, since it's politics and all, you can be accused of wasting money. Oh, well, that's a temporary thing? What a waste of our taxpayer money. Why are you doing that? So city regulators have to think about that. And it is a big challenge. If you're a progressive-minded person within city government, you have to balance
a
lot of those.
It's valuing research and development. And I had a friend from the UK here who was an artist. And they value research and development quite high in the UK. And when they budget for that. And as a citizen, you're quite happy to let an artist figure out what people like. And I guess, yeah, so art usually has that buffer, but with engineering, it should be allowed as part of the larger budget. Is some of these will fail and we're getting to the ones that work. And there's no way that the work one will be first. So going back to some of your past projects, other than parklets and street eateries, I really like the social seating. And I want to know if that was used during the pandemic did you notice an uptick in people sitting outside and outdoors more so than when there wasn't pre-February 2020?
Yeah, so our district is very complex. And so on the eastern side of our district, it's close to our downtown, it's very much a downtown. Tall buildings and universities. And that's been empty for a year and a half. But the western part of our district is dense residential, where people then were, well, the mixture of students that weren't living there because they were living in their hometowns, wherever that is, not Philadelphia. So we were down 10,000 or more of those bodies. But there is a lot of people that live in University City. And so those parks in those areas of our district got more use than they ever have before, and more people coming out, well, more people using them, being out in those spaces, but at the same time, that made it less, there were less people out in our spaces, and so we had certain things that showed up in the eastern part of our district that didn't really show up as much on the western part of our district where more people were.
That's a question
the issue
I have.
We had.
Do you have a plan or suggestion for mayors or city developers on how to help those areas, the downtown areas that have lost all those people, 10,000 students and all those businesses? What, any suggestions?
what's working, one of the reasons why we didn't, why we have small pockets of the city that are like that, that cold kind of emptiness, whereas the neighborhoods all became much more dense. Where there is more residential, there's less of this impact. And so where you have a traditional CBD, central business district, 9 to 5, kind of, you know, Midwestern United States, Southern United States sort of look and feel to it, those took the biggest wallop during the pandemic because there was no reason for any of those people to be there. All those restaurants that existed weren't the nighttime economy. They were the lunch economy. And when that's, so that's just tough. We don't have a lot of solutions for that. We can't force people to come back. We all thought everybody was going to come back to the United States starting in again, Philadelphia is great with vaccines. We are better than most other cities. And the Delta variant, when it came through and whipped through the United States, starting in September, everybody's going to bring all of their staff back. Well, they're like, yeah, January. And now we're getting closer to that. I mean, I don't really know. But then that's the only thing that's really going to get people to kind of come back into those types of areas. But without that residential, where there is residential, it helps so much because you have that mixture during the day and the night, on weekends, there's activity. It has that vibrancy. When you add in all of these streeteries that you have, so now where there used to be restaurants, and maybe you just looked down a commercial corridor or a street and you saw it was a commercial corridor or a street. Now you see 10 streeteries out and all people out. It's vibrant and alive and it feels alive. So even during the pandemic, when we were all locked down and terrified of everything, and you wouldn't even dream of using one of our social seats because you sit next to a stranger, what if they cough on me? Oh my God. And so during all that, it felt vibrant outside because people were using our public spaces. People were out there because it felt safe. The air was moving. It seemed like a safe place to be. So our out of doors was actually doing well. And that's one of the things people say about making these streeteries permanent is one of the only positive things to come out of the pandemic was that we realized you could have a bunch of outdoor seating, and instead of it ruining everything, it made it much better. It made the streets nicer to walk down. It made them seem more alive. We get complaints from, we get negative feedback from people in retail and in other businesses that say, oh my goodness, the streetery is out in front and nobody comes into my store. What I try and remind people, and I have only anecdotal data for this, but what I try and remind people of is, well, when someone is sitting on that streetery, they're parked there staring at your window. And if you have fun stuff in your window, maybe they wouldn't have seen that in their car driving by at 30 miles an hour. But now that they're sitting there and they're looking, maybe you guys can do something with your window displays to try and encourage people to come in, visit your store after they're done eating. And so again, it's just like the way we've all tried to work through this is in the way that kind of tactical urbanists have been doing things for a decade or more. It's where you make your best effort, but you just try it and just let's see what happens and admit that this doesn't have to be the most perfect thing. The more city government does that,
yes,
but allows for checks and balances so there isn't waste and there isn't corruption and there isn't the bad stuff that can come along with it. But if it's legitimately, let's try this out, let's try these, you know, experiment out, whether we call it a pilot project, whether we call it art, or do we call it whatever, non-permanent, like I said, allowing this mentality of we don't have to be perfect, we might not have it all figured out, have checks and balances in where you don't waste $1 million, but, you know, it's thousands of dollars maybe experimenting, trying to figure stuff out, because you might hit gold. You might figure out like, whoa, the city just went nuts and said, we're going to do this and just let it go. We're going to give them permits in 3 days. And now it is changing Philadelphia. There's people are now, all of those people, those restaurateurs that now took and filled out the permits and got their streeteries. Now it's not just Nate at a business improvement district telling the city, this is a good idea. It's 800 restaurant owners that are saying, this is amazing. We love this. So it's creating activists to make streets as places out of an industry that restaurateurs never really thought about it as much, but it's one that we have always depended on to activate our streets.
Detailed questions. One is, if they couldn't speak English and they were a restaurant owner, were they supported for translating? Two, what do you do with the waste management once you, if everyone's put, here we put our bins out on the street. So how did they collect the waste? Was it a specific time frame when people come to pick up the rubbish? Or was it a certain area of the street so it wasn't conflicting with all the dining happening? And then the third is, I interrupted you when you were discussing how it phased in from like six tables in a street eatery to eight, or how they managed how many tables and chairs were in each street eatery and how they crossed from the restaurant. So those are three questions about the specifics of the street eatery.
Yeah. So as the restrictions, as we're trying to figure and learn about COVID and what was the impact and how was it transmitted, all that stuff, there were restrictions. The first was, okay, you can have outdoor dining, but the only people at your table, there can only be four, and they all must be from the same household. So if you're a family of six, too bad. But that was just trying to get, like, not having four different individuals from different houses come and cough on each other, and then they spread COVID further. Then it became six people. As things got a little bit, well, we understand it a little bit more, but still the same household. And so really it was only this summer of 21, when they lifted those restrictions and said, okay, you could be from different households and sit at the same table outside. So that is always changing. Again, well, you get criticized here for that kind of stuff, but it is the best for the citizenry because they didn't sit and wait around for it to be perfect. They said, well, let's try this. And oh my goodness, is this not working? Let's make adjustments. Let's try and help, because the goal was to try and, well, what was to help keep the city alive.
And someone
alive.
Has to make that a law, right? Someone has to say, okay, four is too little. Someone up top is going.
Yes, that was our health department that was always in control of that. So Philadelphia Public Health Department was, they would have weekly press conferences and all the people in my world would watch them every week. What do they say? What's happening? What is this variant? Oh my goodness. Are they going to let people eat inside? So we would all just watch with bated breath every week, our health department briefings. And we would all get emails with, you know, here's the new rules. But that was constantly changing. Another thing we did in Philadelphia, which I want every city to do this, again, because of that Zoom, I mentioned earlier that I think the city was able to get more panels of experts in because it was easier with a Zoom panel than with physically getting people in a room. Approvals and other things that, well, now I'm going off on a tangent, but this, I'll go back, the idea that the whole,
it's
everything
okay.
that happens
I think,
in these,
I think it's the, important that you found the thread, because the questions were very specific, right? About waste, amount of tables, and I forgot the last one, but we'll get there. And it's the tangent's important because you're realizing that the reason all three of those questions are answered is because of a Zoom panel. So you're answering that question with one concept, which is, I'll let you finish, that the Zoom panels allowed for what?
They just allowed for more people to be involved, because to me, in community development, what is the biggest problem is getting those voices from people, getting voices from individuals who maybe don't like this, or maybe they really do like this. A big issue with equity in informing the public about projects has come up a lot, certainly before the pandemic, but absolutely during it. But if you have an evening meeting where you have a bunch of renderings up on a wall in a church basement, and you invite the public in and you're going to talk about your project, and six people show up, and that's supposed to represent the community. Did you provide childcare? Did you pay the people for coming? Did you provide a meal? So are you getting the community? Are they even coming to this event? You have to get past the obvious barrier of having a smartphone and having internet, but assuming you have access to that, and there are ways for where that was made available to the lowest income individuals. But getting that bigger feedback, that more voices, more people, you know, instead of six people, it's 300 or 400 people are chiming in on something. And you get a more well-rounded idea of something, not just the loudest people who scream and yell. For all I know, the fact that it wasn't just the one person calling up a council member and saying, my parking space is gone, there's a stupid streetery there. Instead, there were hundreds of people chiming in on social media and other things saying how much they loved it. Well, I know that helped the city government hear more of the positive voices, the people that aren't used to saying things to city government when things are good. You only say when things are bad, right? So I think it helps more voices get heard. And I think that's really important. And when our projects, Mike Lydon, the sort of one of the fathers of tactical urbanism, a phrase he uses that I love to use is a rendering in real time. So when you put bales of hay and some planters and stuff out somewhere, that's a rendering in real time. People can come out and say, I like that, I don't like that, that's too big, that's too small, or this is changing things too much, or I love this, this is amazing. That those renderings in real time allow feedback. You can get so much information from people, and that anytime a project can be phased or could be introduced to the public in these different iterations, it changes their sense of ownership of that space. And so it goes down to this philosophically, the old William White adage. Have you ever seen the Social Life Smallwood Spaces video from the 70s?
No, I need to.
It's great. It's on YouTube. It's wonderful. Everybody's wearing amazing, you know, plaid bell-bottom pants. It's great. It's New York City in the 70s. But he has this one thing where everybody, even the slightest move, if you go in a public space or a restaurant or anything, and there's a chair sitting there and it can move, you will move it ever so slightly just to make it yours. Very rarely does someone just walk in and sit right down in a chair and be like, what's up? And it's like, you're always like, he's twisted a little bit. It makes it yours. It gives you a sense of ownership. It's like, I'm facing the direction I want to face. When you give people options and they can have feedback that is adapted, mm-hmm. and people say like, well, our big space is an experimental space, the porch at 30th Street Station outside of the third busiest train station in the United States.
Yes.
We didn't have the perfect idea. We didn't know what it was. We put something out there with our best guess, and then we asked people, we did surveys. What do you like? What do you dislike? How can you change things? And we made changes over the years because they told us they wanted more shade and more plants and other things. But we had no ability to find that out first.
So how do you support the restaurants making a street eatery? Because we have some in our CBD, which they don't like to call it that because people live there now and they're trying to make it like a livable shared use space. But in that area, there are some immigrant families who particularly, I specifically will send all the updates to, but they're A, not getting them, and B, how do you talk them through the process? So let's say it's a new immigrant, they've opened a new restaurant pre-COVID, and they don't have as much access to all those, understanding all the paperwork or understanding. Did you have a group that tried to help them have successful outcomes based on their English knowledge and knowledge of bureaucracy?
Yes, and the city of Philadelphia is good with that. I believe everything they put out was in English, Spanish, and Mandarin. So that's not certainly all languages spoken in Philadelphia, but those are the three major ones. That's an issue across. I mean, part of the issue with street eateries, and as it's to get more permanent, and they want to think, how can we have these permanent beyond the pandemic? One of the things that was wonderful about the emergency declaration, you could have a bucket with gravel and a stick connecting with a rope to another bucket with a stick. That's your parklet, and it's sitting on the street. And you put out some folding tables and chairs. It might have cost you $15. It cost nothing.
Yes.
That allowed sort of first generation immigrants, people that just didn't have the networks and the income to build a $25,000, $30,000 beautiful streetery. They only had, you know, pennies to rub together. And they were like, here's something we can do.
People could.
That's powerful. They said it didn't have to be the world's most perfect thing. You could try this little thing for the pandemic. Now it seems people are going away from that, saying now the city is, the language in the draft stuff is it has to be crash worthy, not defined. So what does that mean? So a bucket with a stick is probably not crash worthy. Yeah. But that goes against those communities of individuals that often are in the food service industry. Often new immigrants, new Americans come and open restaurants and bring their culture to this new city where they live.
Bureaucracy, including equity, I guess. So when we move from the emergency declaration to crash worthy, how are we incorporating in equity? an equity lens so people can dine safely in this space.
It's amazing. And one thing I'll say about equity is incredible. I mentioned before, we have a strong mayor, but we also have strong council districts. Where my organization is located, University City District, is in Philadelphia, Council District 3. That's not Center City, which is where our downtown, but all the other areas, nobody could agree where these streeteries go permanently. So most of the council districts, including my Fishtown where I live, where it's hipsters and everybody's, you know, concerts and everything, it was like specific commercial corridors could have streeteries. Our councilwoman, so her name is Councilwoman Jamie Gauthier. She's a District 3 council member. She's an urban planning degree, so it's really wonderful. She said her entire District 3 could have a streetery. The whole district by right. It's the only district in the entire city, and it's a huge chunk of the city where she's just like, boom.
Awesome.
Everybody can do this by right. That's by far the most equitable approach to any part of the city. Center City is different. They have all the same rule. Well, that's by right. And that's a little bit different. So basically everybody else wanted to be like the downtown core always had outdoor dining by right, but not in the street, just on the sidewalk. And so this is now where I am in West Philadelphia. It's now the whole district could have streeteries. So anybody could have. So that gets into translation services. How do you do it? So as a city, I don't really know. Like I said, our Commerce Department has that stuff. We, as University City District, mm-hmm. in the past, when we were trying to install parklets mm-hmm. in front of restaurants that had people that didn't speak English or didn't want to speak English to me, whatever the case might be, what do we do? A couple of different times, we actually went to University of Pennsylvania, which happens to be in our district, has language translation services. So we would actually get some students that speak whatever language yes. these individuals spoke. And we could go down there and say, this is what we want to say to you. We'd pay that student a little bit of money and help. So that is possible. And if you go into that with intentionality, if your intentionality is equitability, if your intentionality is to try and get as many people as possible, and you're not thinking about translation services, that's not going to be equitable.
Yeah.
That's not going to help you. And so I think that's as my experience in general, the people of New Zealand seem to be much more cognizant of others and others that aren't necessarily in the majority than we might be here in the U.S.
Well, because you have that crash-worthy barrier, right? So for you, we don't front-foot it with, let's say you look at, and there's a trend that the people who are new immigrants have the non-crash-worthy. It's almost seems purposeful, but it's not. So the way you can help that is just say, hey, we've changed the law in their language to explain how the law has changed. And this is the next step you need to do if you want to continue to keep this eatery. That's ahead of the curve, right? But that an emergency declaration shouldn't give them hope and then accidentally one line in a law takes it away, and they don't, and people aren't paying attention to those little laws when they're right. doing something.
They're trying to keep their business open. It.
But it's all those things when you're planning cities. I did not expect when I was working on these low traffic neighborhoods that the largest barrier was going to be how the truck picks up the rubbish. So
where it became an issue was not just the individual replacing a parking lane spot with a platform, because that's really not changing anything. The trash trucks can still go through. It's when, and this happened in a few different parts across the city, the entire street was closed. And so no traffic was getting through, all for outdoor dining. And we did that at one particular block in our district called 3400 block of Sansom Street. We've had that closed down for a year and a half, every day for full 24 hours for wow. outdoor dining. And it's been, and I have to get permits every 2 weeks. It's been quite a challenge to do that, but it's happening. And all of those restaurants just figured it out together because none of them wanted trash building up everywhere. So they all like agreed to something, and we'll clear space so that the trucks can come through. So it became this local solution, and the city didn't have to figure that out. The city just, what they said to us, the way the city of Philadelphia guidelines broke down is if you're doing a streetery or a sidewalk cafe, that's where the tables and chairs are just on the sidewalk, then you, the restaurant, can do that all on your own as long as you have the permission of the building owner, where your restaurant is, that's fine. But if you want to close down a whole street, you got to get a bigger entity involved. You got to get a bid or business improvement district involved. So that's when we did the full closures. I separated that. So I told the restaurants, I want to help you because I know this stuff. You don't. These were three of these places that we helped out were iconic places in University City. We wanted to keep them. I said, I'll do the red tape stuff. I'll do all the government stuff, but I don't know anything about the health department or the liquor control. So if you keep taking care of that and you keep, because you hold those permits and you have those licenses, I don't. I'm just allowing you to do this, assuming you're following all those rules, doing it in the street. That helped them. Well, it allowed them to do it because I didn't, from my standpoint, I could help these restaurants without knowing all of the nuances of the health code, of you know, liquor code, all that stuff. So I'm not setting myself up for failure because I don't know all that stuff.
You're just giving permission in the street. Yeah.
I know how to do things in the street. And so I can figure out how to make that work. They're figuring out how to do the restaurant side of it. And it's been this perfect combination where it's allowed it to happen for over a year and a half.
And you have 100% approval though. So let's say, I don't know if it's all restaurants, because there's also, do people live above the restaurant? So what about the residents? So what was the permissions you needed from the residents that live on that open street and the businesses? Was it 100%, 80%? What are some of the feedback you've received on that year and a half?
We have 100% of the businesses on that block are restaurants and they're all for it. It seems that all of the individuals that have decided to live in the apartments above those restaurants love living near a restaurant, and we haven't received any complaints from the residents. Across the street from this is the law school for the University of Pennsylvania, and they haven't loved it as much. So we've had certain issues. Their feedback has been mostly on access to their building and how there's been some difficulties there. And we've made adjustments. And so that's another example where, as the liaison, basically what I could do is I could talk to the restaurant and get their 100% real, honest feedback. And then I could translate that to the property owner and what they want. And then I'd have to translate all that to the city and then get the city. So it really helped because the city can come off as caustic to these restaurants. They could be curt and like to the, you know, and it makes people upset. And like, because they have to talk to 600 restaurants today. And like, I can't do this, you know, hold your hand through all of this. But to me, that was a stroke of genius that the city of Philadelphia said, okay, if you're going to do this, have a business improvement district or like entity, a nonprofit that talks about those certain chunks of cities. Let them be in charge of these things. That was key. I think that was a really, really helpful move. Going forward, though, once the emergency declaration ends, the full street closures for outdoor dining, that was decided not to continue in Philadelphia permanently.
Can they do it like Friday, Saturday nights? Or can they do... because I had a similar issue here in Auckland with the street, and the idea was that every Thursday it closed for a farmer's market, let's say. So now that you have the paperwork, now that you have the permission, is there a way to adapt it from the emergency to a Thursday, Friday night situation?
Yeah, I think so. And I think there is energy in city government, in our streets department, to try and think through some of that stuff. The legitimate... well, all the complaints are legitimate, anybody's feelings of something, but the big challenge is when buses need to get through there and the buses had to be rerouted to go around that, does that displace the number of passengers that have to walk an extra block or two? So it's like, it's real things like that. Is during the declaration, you could put a streetery on a bike lane. Like, look, it's, if your restaurant is out in front of a bike lane, fine, you can do that. Now, cycling has been through the roof in Philadelphia during the pandemic, and people are like, it was fine because there weren't as many people moving around. But now that it's, people are coming downtown and they are using it more, now cyclists are saying, like, you can't have these streeteries in the bike lane. That's our only way to get through the city without getting hit by cars.
Safety, yeah.
So it's this, so now the city's having to go and tell people you cannot have it in bike lanes.
My other question is that we haven't gone into is, I was talking about smells, eats, and senses of a city. And in Philly, you have that corner, just since we're talking about food places, where the two Philly cheesesteaks are diagonal. How are they going?
Pats and Gina.
Yeah, yeah.
They're still doing it 24/7 every day of the year. They keep going. They didn't seem to, I mean, they probably shut down in March too for a little bit. And cheesesteaks aren't, well, I don't know. They're not really the kind of thing you get to go, well, delivered, but I suppose that could happen.
What's your those, smell?
Yeah, there's
your,
been.
What's your Philly smell and taste and sense where you know that if you smelt it overseas, it reminds you of home, or when you're in Philly, you smell or the sense where you're like, yes.
Oh, it's so for us, I have a house of three vegetarians, my wife and daughters, and I'm really close. So the traditional things, cheesesteaks and roast pork, that are things that are really popular here, aren't as popular in my house. But the thing we would, oh my goodness, if we were, we left Philadelphia ever, we love it here, we don't plan to, but if we did, the first things we would miss are the bread. Bread in Philadelphia is just so much better than any other US city, maybe save for San Francisco. But bread is so good and it makes all the rolls work. So stiff, long, good breads for hoagies and for good sandwiches, that's really important. I would definitely smell that. Soft pretzels are such a part of Philadelphia. Bavarian style soft pretzels. It's big, big. It always has been big in Philadelphia. That's such a smell and a texture and sense. It's this thing that kids have in school. Not during the pandemic, but the trays would come around. Before the pandemic, yeah. And they would have the pretzels come. Oh yeah, the vendors would be at every street corner,
wow,
selling hot pretzels. Shopping carts with a metal tray. With coals underneath it, keeping the pretzels on top of it warm, selling them for 50 cents a piece across. It's such a Philadelphia thing. It happens all the time. It's wonderful and delightful, and we love it so much. Even if the pretzels are a little bit old and not quite as warm as they once were, but those kinds of scents and smells, that is absolutely the kind of stuff that just would make you want to think. Takes you right back to those places.
So they're kind of like your hero, eh? The pretzel people are your community heroes almost. If you had to pick one through this COVID response pandemic, are there any people that have been really like the lady in your district, the district counselor, for instance, are there any other members that are just restaurant owners or citizens that really stepped it up and helped improve or part of the emergency declaration that you recognize?
You know, so many restaurateurs through these Zoom meetings, and the city would ask and have restaurateurs on Zoom meetings. Just last week, I testified to city council about the value of outdoor dining and we had to convince the council members that the pandemic was still impactful on these restaurants. They said, oh, I see all these restaurants are full. They must be fine. And the restaurateurs come on like, I second mortgaged my house. I was hemorrhaging money for a year and a half. Okay, so maybe I'm busy now, but I have a year and a half to recover from. And I had to lay off 40 people in March of 2020, and I'm slowly bringing them back. And it's
they have to be brave to do that and not sob in front of the counselors, right? Because they want to come across as, this is our life and you don't understand it. Let us, and we are used to testifying in front of council, right? We know how to introduce ourselves. We know how to, yes, help with the planning permission. So it's almost as if when you have this restaurateur stand in those environments, are they ready? And that's really brave to go in front of these strangers, and you're almost, yeah, begging, but you don't want to beg.
And it helps. It helps. It's the kind of thing, how would that restaurant owner in normal times ever sign up, go to city council, go to city hall, get checked in, sit down, wait for your turn, stand up, then testify, versus turning away from the kitchen at this exact moment, logging onto Zoom, doing your testimony, and then going back to whatever you were doing. That allowed so many more people to be able to say, this is what life is like. Like, I'm right here in my kitchen right now. You want to see it?
What was it called? Was it called like a restaurant? Like, this is a great idea and I'm going to put it forward. What was the title of the meeting?
So another council member here, Alan Dom, council member Dom, had this restaurant working group weekly Zoom meeting with people from the lobbying group, the PRLA, the Pennsylvania Restaurant and Lodging Association. They would have members of that team on the call. We'd have city government on the call, and restaurants would just check in, and they would just say, here's what's happening. This is what happened today or this week, or this was a terrible week. We had a hurricane, you know, no business, but it was this, like these check-ins. That is something I don't know that that's ever gonna, how it continues. But to me, that was one huge gift of Zoom or any sort of platform.
Who hosted that platform? Who said, all right.
That was that particular restaurant working group was Councilman Dom. Okay. He hosted that Zoom call. He invited everybody in and he would say, I'm fighting for this. I'm pushing for this. He personally owns restaurants.
Oh yeah, that's fine though. That's why you elected
people. But it's full disclosure. There's nothing, everything is out there. Everybody knows.
It reminds you, when you vote, it matters. Because if you vote someone who owns a restaurant and you're a restaurant owner, they have your perspective. So it just gives you a kind of eye line into, once in power, are they your perspective and why voting matters? That's interesting.
So that was Councilman Dom did that for the restaurant and hospitality working group. That was the industry came in and would just, it was a therapy session for most people for most of the pandemic, but it really helped things move along. The city had a couple of different, the groups that the city had, basically, if you had that full outdoor closure where the whole street was closed for outdoor dining and the bid had to be involved, there was a weekly call with all of the group that did that. It was an hour or 2 hours every week with high level city officials. So not just people that could say like, oh, let me get back to you on that. Like the head of the department, the person that could say, yes, we can let you do that. Or I will talk directly to one of my staffers who can get that. And that was key. So it was Zoom and it was high level people. And that was for the full street closures. If you got a streetery, well, but there was several of these groups that the city would orchestrate that allowed people in this industry to chime in and say what they think. They could talk about the challenges of liquor control approvals, of enforcement. For example, these calls, when we would have them, the city would always say during the pandemic, if someone comes out and gives you a ticket for this, if someone finds you for this, let us know and we'll get them waived because we're not charging any fines during the pandemic, whatever. But the inspectors themselves might go out and do that. So we could then have a forum of saying like, hey, four restaurants on our corridor have been getting targeted by this, by inspectors. What is this? And there's immediate action from the city of saying like, who are those inspectors? What can we do?
No one's in trouble. It's just communication. It's the opposite.
Right. But if there is something dangerous, let's fix that. You're not going to get fined, but you do have to fix that. So it was basically the people in positions like mine, in positions like another one of our city officials, Mike Carroll, who is sort of the head of the streets department and has facilitated so many of these things, you have to have the thickest skin. You just can't get upset by the, like people are going to scream at you. People are going to,
they don't know what they don't know, right?
So a lot of people have just gotten really thick skin over the last 2 years and just have heard a lot. But I just think that being able to have people talk directly to the city, these aren't like low-level staffers
and
at the restaurants. It's the restaurant owner.
Knowing there's going to be action on the other end, though. So it's not time wasted.
Right. Especially in the hospitality industry where every minute is so precious and you work off hours. So your 9 to 11 in the morning is for doing very important, you know, bookkeeping and other things. You don't have time to do all these meetings. And so that meeting people where they are, to me, that is something I think the Zoom or whatever the platform, whatever this video call platform of whatever people use should be something we keep going forward. I think it helps get more people involved. I think it helps get, and it's obviously there's downfalls to it, but it allows more people to get their say. It allows city government to be better informed.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. So take this council member Dom, who's creating these restaurant bills. Normally, who's going to call the council member's office? Do you think the 26-year-old hipster who just had a great time at the outdoor dining and met the love of his life has had dinner and they're going to go out partying? You think they're going to call and say these things? So you don't hear all that. You don't hear the good from people. You hear that negative, and you hear all these. When you have this open forum where you have industry talking directly to the lawmakers are getting a better informed opinion of what they're doing and who it actually impacts. That is humongous to me. That's what we always talk about with equity, with you know, not needing to know somebody to allow this to happen. Let it be by right. You don't have to know somebody to get this, because how's that new American going to be able to come in and set up a restaurant their first year in this country and have to know people? That's ridiculous.
Yeah, that's, you're bringing that's it into not, this space, a safe space. And so this is a great way to end our conversation today. And I think that is the takeaway, is that a lot of my work before the pandemic was I would survey restaurants one of the briefs would say you can only go between 3 and 5, or you could only go between 9:30 and 10. Like, I knew the windows when you would, and I would tell surveyors to interview while they're working. So if they're making a coffee and you're asking them about how their customers are receiving things, that's the way it's meant to be. Don't wait for them to stop working. Most restaurant retail, I've always interviewed retail while they're steaming stuff or folding, because I think, whereas if you're in government, you don't realize that that's how people operate on the street, right? So Zoom is the same idea. And it's nice to hear that you're Zooming from the restaurants and you're really meeting people where they are. So I can't wait to see these links you're going to send me of the city streets closed and the other one we were talking about and the documents. Where can people, if they go hunt you out, where can they learn more about your work?
So my company is University City District, and we are universitycity.org as our website. And you can find any number of things, our publications about public spaces and the workforce development that we do and all the other things that my organization does. If they want to follow along with my musings, I'm just, my last name is unique enough. So I'm Nate Hummel, just simple NateHummel for Twitter, underscore between Nate and Hummel for Instagram, easy to find. My kids like to remind me there are videos of me on the internet. And there's another, you could, I suppose, just try it that way too, for those types of things. But the best bet is our social media and following on universitycity.org. And we'll be putting out our year-end report very soon, State of University City for 2021. And we'll have a lot more, a lot of our data on what we actually did in how we help businesses and during these last, we're getting close to 2 years, but almost, yeah, year and a half, how we've changed our approach to try and save as many businesses as we can, using our knowledge of how cities work and how we can find our way in and change things.
Amazing. Well, having you here today has been really great. Thank you for sharing us with the importance of temporary processes that can lead to long-term improvements.
Thank you very much. It's been a pleasure.
If you enjoyed today's podcast, please share with a friend and let's continue to grow and trial new ways of collaborating and creating in our cities and in places across the globe. Thank you for listening.